This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps. Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. For this episode, we're talking all about counselling. It's something that's come up on many episodes as something you can get for support dealing with mental illness. And so I really wanted to devote an episode to it specifically and get into a little bit more of what counselling means, what the different types are, and hear directly from a counsellor what that experience is like from the other side. And so before we get into any of that, I've just got a few statistics to start us off. So first of all, it's important to note how common it is that people go for counselling. So The Guardian found almost 1 in 5 people has consulted a counsellor or psychotherapist, whilst almost half of the population know someone who has. And that's from a survey by the British Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy. That's the BACP. They are also the people that essentially regulate counsellors. So we mentioned in the episode about how you can sort of check that the counsellor is accredited, and it's through the BACP website you can do that, and it has lists of counsellors as well if you want to find one. So I'm also here with my podcast assistant, Annie. So what do you think of that stat, first of all?
So I think it's really heartening to hear, actually, because I know that through Mind statistics that 1 in 4 people in the UK will have a lived experience of a mental health problem. So to know that 1 in 5 people are seeking counselling is actually really heartening to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important there as well that they noted that it's almost half of the population who know someone that has gone to counselling.
Yeah.
And so that's really what we wanted to highlight here, how common it is, how many people need that kind of support. As someone that's had experience of going to counselling, and I still go to it now, I'm quite biased. If it was up to me, everyone would have
support. Sure, yeah, it's like a mandatory kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, like an initiation, like a rite of passage almost.
Yeah, well, because it's so helpful just to understand you better, whether that means to help with mental health or not.
Yeah, and I really think that it offers you that insight into sort of who you are as a person and how you work and how other people work, and sort of understanding that and really bringing out that idea of emotional intelligence. And if anything, it just helps us to be better people for each other, which I think is so important.
Absolutely. And so another set I have here, I think is quite interesting, from the Counselling Directory. According to the 2014 study carried out by We Need to Talk Coalition, is that the right word?
Yeah. Coalition sounds good to me. Apart, well, the pronunciation sounds good, not the actual thing itself.
Not the political stuff. Out of 2,000 people who tried accessing talking therapies in 2014, only 15% were offered the full range recommended by the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, who are known as NICE. And I think that's a really important thing to note of how common it is that people go through an NHS experience is the most common one, where they're referred for counselling, and they're not talked through the types, and they're just kind of, it's chosen for them.
Sure, yeah. I think I have a sort of very personal experience of that, in that I had some mental health support a couple of years ago, and they said to me, we're going to put you in some group therapy. And I said, oh, I don't really think this is right for me. And they said, well, we're going to put you in it anyway. Like, we've decided that this is the thing that we can offer you and the best thing for you at this time. And I knew it wasn't the right thing for me, but I thought, if it's the only thing that's on offer, then of course I'm going to take it. You know, it's like being offered food and saying, well, this food isn't enough for me, so I'm going to throw it in the bin. It's like, well, no, eat the food that's already there, right?
Yeah.
That's how I compared it.
Absolutely, like, it wouldn't be an Annie analogy otherwise.
Absolutely, an analogy, yeah. I thought it was just silly. I was like, well, of course I'm going to take it, but I know this isn't right for me. But I thought, better than now.
So, yeah, I think that's an important point. And often I think it can be that because people don't always understand the different types of counselling, that can mean even when you're going down the private route and you're sourcing it yourself, as we discussed, I think, a little in the episode, it can be quite overwhelming, all the different types. And so, for example, if you go through our website, mentalpodcast.co.uk, you can find a directory there and various resources on getting these kind of support. But you, most of the time, they just, the counsellors will list the type of counselling, one or more, that they do. And as outsiders to it, it's not always clear what those mean.
Sure.
So in my own rudimentary way, I'm going to just try and sum up a little bit what the main three approaches that are seen in the UK are. There are a lot that offshoot from this, and there are a lot outside of it. Group therapy is like a different setup as well in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that you may most commonly come across on counselling directories are person-centred, which is very much a client-focused setup. So it comes from the belief that the client has the answers and they will lead the conversation to where it needs to be and the things they need to
facilitate
work on.
Facilitate that journey, if you like.
Exactly. And that one's often referred to specifically as talking therapy,
mm-hmm.
because it's very much about the client bringing each week or each 2 weeks or however often the things that are on their mind, the things that they feel they need to work on for whatever reason. And then the counsellor is there to try and encourage them to think and see a little bit further.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they have this field of awareness, and often with the counsellor's training and expertise, they can see things that the client may not.
Yeah.
And it's trying to bring in this additional insight.
Absolutely. I think it's really important, I think, to have a sort of neutral party, almost like a sort of I sort of imagine them sort of like a higher force, like an angel, sort of able to look at the whole situation as it is. I think very much when you're suffering with a mental health problem, that it's really hard to see the bigger picture. It's very easy to isolate yourself in a, I feel terrible, or I feel horrible, or nothing will ever get better. But the counsellor doesn't have that, they may or may not have that internal experience, but it's certainly not about your problem itself. You know, they're able to look at your situation mm-hmm. as a big jigsaw puzzle, like a big finished jigsaw puzzle, and all we can see is maybe a couple of pieces and we can't find the other pieces, whereas that counsellor is able to turn around and say, here are your other pieces, you had them all along, you know, and sort of shine a light on that. I'm all about the metaphors today. The analogies.
Yeah. And so the next of the most common ones is cognitive behavioural therapy. That's often abbreviated to CBT. And so with that, that's more of a skills focus type of therapy, where the counsellor will have a set of kind of skills and techniques they've learned, and they apply those that are most appropriate for that client to try and give them a kind of tool set to navigate what they're going through. And that's particularly recommended for severe like anxiety disorders, for example, where people need like basic tools that may not even seem that big, like breathing techniques, but mm-hmm. that will allow them to easier get through their day.
Mm-hmm.
And from that place of more comfort, they can then delve into deeper things.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third most common, which is the type our guest today is integrative, which is where it's a combination of multiple types, generally those first two I've mentioned, and possibly more. And so they tend to try and give a more overall approach, where they bring in the different approaches as needs for that client. And it's generally recommended that counsellors learn more than one type. But those are the most common. There are many more specific types. And even within those, counsellors can have specialties. Like some will have it in grief, some will have it in like LGBT issues.
Mm-hmm.
So you can definitely look out for that as well.
Mm. I think I just wanted to pick up on something that you said about the CBT. When you were talking about these tools that people have, or sorry, that people are taught, I was thinking about how we did the cycle of thoughts, behaviours, feelings and situation. I can't remember, there was sort of like a four-prong sort of cycle, and the way that we sort of broke that cycle was the only thing that we could control was our thoughts. And then you said something about breathing techniques, and I was like, oh, I never really sort of picked up on the, I'm sure they were mentioned at some point, mm-hmm. but I never really picked up on the breathing techniques. thing in CBT. That was something that I very much took for myself from my meditative and sort of mindfulness practice. And the thing that I really took from CBT was the idea that I can control my thoughts. I was thinking, oh, you know, that thing doesn't work for everyone. And then you said something about breathing techniques. And I was like, it's so lovely to hear that people take different things from CBT that work for them. Mm-hmm. But then you went on to talk about integrative counselling or integrative therapy. And I love the idea that it's sort of all of the specialties, if you like, coming together in a very holistic way. And I think like healing from or journeys of mental illness or mental illness of mental illness recovery can be very holistic. I mean, certainly for me, I felt that at first it was a problem with my mind, and then I realised that it was a problem with my body, and then I sort of brought in some spiritual elements, which obviously some people can and can't do. Like, I'm personally a Buddhist, and that's something that's been very helpful in my recovery. But yeah, I just love the idea of all of those things coming together to create something very rounded in a way. I think that's really lovely. I've not heard about that before, and I just realised it was super lovely. That makes me really happy to hear about it.
Great. And so in a moment then we'll get into our episode with Grainne Clancy, and she is joining us via the wonders of Skype from Dublin. And so it's quite interesting to get that perspective of mental health from a different angle, and hopefully cater a little bit to our Irish listeners as well. She's a delight. She's lovely to speak to. I certainly felt very comfortable speaking to her, as you'd imagine, with a counsellor. And so, yeah, enjoy, and we'll get into that in just a moment. But first,
this week's Audible recommendation.
I'm recommending Weight Expectations: One Man's Recovery from Anorexia. Part memoir, part self-help guide, this witty book will take you through the day-to-day struggles of living with an eating disorder. Stand-up comedian Dave Chawner tells the story of how he became anorexic, what his life with mental illness was like, and how he started his journey to recovery. If you want to try this book or any other books for free from Audible, follow our link to bit.ly/mentalbooks.
Hi Bobby, my name is Grainne Clancy and I am originally from County Antrim, so I suppose my mental health journey has kind of been there all my life, even though I didn't realise it. So I was born in the 70s, in the height of the Troubles. And it wasn't really until I moved to Dublin that I realised that I was actually a very anxious person.
Okay.
And my journey started way back, I suppose, when I was a student nurse. And I was very panicky about finishing my training, about the responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so I went to counselling for 6 sessions, that's what we got. Part of occupational health, and that was kind of the start of the process of knowing that that's what it was about, and about getting to know myself a little bit. But it's kind of been this gradual journey of acknowledgement, because I used to say, oh no, the Troubles didn't affect me, and they affected everybody, and I was always knew I was very sensitive. But it was really my training as a counsellor that kind of made me, I suppose, allowed me to get to know myself. There have been a lot of, you know, it's been a bumpy road. Mm-hmm.
And could we just, before we get into your counselling, then, so in terms of like back in the early days, was there a particular time when you started having these things? Symptoms of anxiety? Are you able to trace back sort of?
I'm able to trace back. I would say to primary school. Mm-hmm. When I first started primary school, they asked me, "Was my name? Your name couldn't possibly be Grainne." It was a conversation, and I got very upset and annoyed. And it was, you know, are you sure it's not this Sonia or other names? And I got very anxious and angry about it, that yes, my name is Grainne. So that,
and was that the other kids saying that?
Yeah, that was older kids asking me, because it wasn't in the 70s, Grainne was not a popular name. Mm-hmm. And so I was only Grainne in my school that had it. So yeah, so immediately from that young age I felt different.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there was that. Yeah, and then when I was 5 as well, so around the same time, we discovered that I needed glasses. Mm-hmm. So I was wearing glasses, and in 1970s National Health Service, the first pair of glasses that I wore were brown glasses. So I had a different name and I wore glasses. So all the usual comments about, you know, four eyes and specky four eyes. So I was never confident.
Mm-hmm. And it sort of makes sense. It's interesting you mentioned your name there and how people are picking on you because it was uncommon. Because my understanding is that with young children in particular, taking issue with their name, or even worse, refusing to use their name, is one of the worst things you can do, because they're still so early on in understanding who they are and forming their own identity. So yeah. Then for people to challenge something about you that you always just took for granted as, you know, this is who I am. I can imagine how traumatic that could be.
Yeah, and then the backdrop of, you know, I grew up Catholic, and I went to a different school to two other children that lived nearby. So mm-hmm. I had friends that went to one school and I went to a different school. So it was kind of compartmentalized. The children, the people I played with after school, I didn't play with in school.
Yeah, no, I think that's such a common experience. It's funny, actually, even over here, a lot of the Irish that moved over brought that kind of culture with them. I've got a friend from Liverpool, and mm-hmm. she grew up around a similar time. And she there was like a railway track through Liverpool, and so the Irish community were around it, and the Catholics lived on one side and the Protestants lived on the other, and their churches were both on the wrong side of the track. So she uh-huh. painted this like crazy image of like all the Protestants driving round and then all the Catholics taking the bridge over the railway. And that was every Sunday. And she told me that, you know, when she, because back in those days, obviously it was landlines. And if she was talking to anyone on the landline and her dad saw her, he'd ask her what the name of that child was. And if he knew it was, she was Catholic, so if he knew it was a Protestant boy, he'd go over and he'd just hang up the phone and there'd be no more said about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And yet I grew up in a council estate, and then when I was about 11, we moved.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always very mixed, you know, so that I had that right throughout my life, that, you know, as a teenager as well, that my relationship, so relationships in school and relationships, everything was kind of very boundaries
mm-hmm.
in that time. And then there was always the, you know, looking back now, I can see, like, there used to be on the television, will all key holders please, you know, check into their premises, which now I know was like, oh, there was a bomb scare
mm-hmm.
and it was supposed to do a check to see exactly where people were. But that was normal. Getting bags checked was normal, do you know?
Yeah.
And people don't understand that. Well, how could it be normal? But it was. It was. I didn't know any different. But
yeah, that was your reality.
Yeah, that was going on. But I suppose because going back to my you know, primary school, and there was a lot of bullying, and for those reasons that I was what you call it, a different name. So, and from a very early age, I stood out. And I'm a chatterbox as well. Mm-hmm. So I stood out, but kind of for the wrong reasons. So there was always that feeling, that need to belong and to be part of the gang. And I never really felt that growing up.
Yeah, I understand that. And I imagine with a lot of those experiences, then when you moved to Dublin, it may have taken that to realise how different it was and how a lot of what you'd gone through growing up wasn't normal for a lot of people.
No. And not just Dublin, moving to Aberdeen. When I moved to Aberdeen to do my nurse's training,
mm-hmm.
it was very much on the background of, I ended up, like, I had moved out of my parents' home into my own flat, and I'd never lived on my own before, and it was very lonely. It was hard because, I was learning about money. And it was very lonely, so I worked full-time, and kind of my life for a long time revolved around work. So there wasn't I would have went out, initially when I moved there, I would have went out quite a bit, but when I got my own flat, because finances and whatever, I wouldn't have went out the same, so it was actually really lonely. And I was, a few things happened, but I was burgled, and I ended up having reactionary depression.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think, I also know now, because I was working, I worked as a nursing auxiliary in a medical ward, which was, there was a lot going on, and that ward was very, very busy. It wore me down, do you know? It really, really wore me down, and I was kind of like, I suppose I was 23, 24. Is this what life's about? You know, is this what work's about?
Mm-hmm.
And it was tough, and it was lonely, and I suppose because I had that chronic stress and the anxiety, I really didn't know how to deal with it. So I would have listened to music, but the tiredness would have really been a huge issue for me, and it crept up and up. And then eventually I was diagnosed with depression.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of age were you at that point?
I would have been 25.
Okay, so all of this was still when you were relatively young.
Yeah.
And so what sort of support did you get with the depression?
Well, my GP put me on Prozac 20 milligrams, mm-hmm. and I was referred to the psychiatric team, so I was seen by the community psychiatric nurse, and I also moved home, so that was actually really good, very supportive. So my mum got me into a routine, so I wasn't allowed to, you know, spend all day in my pyjamas. I had to get up and get out.
Yeah, mums are good at that.
Yeah, they are. But it was good and was structured. And then I would have seen the community psychiatric nurse as well for support. And during that time, I had applied for my nurse's training in Aberdeen. So the June was kind of when I would have been, May, June, I would have been diagnosed with the depression and put on the Prozac. And then in September, I got an interview
mm-hmm.
in Aberdeen to start my nurse's training. And I remember going over to Aberdeen. And it was kind of surreal because I was feeling a lot better. But it was strange being on my own again in this strange city that where I knew nobody. But it felt right. It felt like a good move.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it. And I can remember my community psychiatric. This is like 1999.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? My community psychiatric nurse said to me, "Don't tell them that you're depressed."
Oh, wow.
And I can remember also my ward manager at the time saying to me, "If you start taking antidepressants, you can kiss a career nursing goodbye."
Wow. That's something I was going to ask you about, actually, how comfortable you felt talking about what you were going through when you were in a position like nursing. And it sounds like you didn't even get the chance to decide how accepting it was because other people were warning you off talking about mental health.
Yeah. Totally. And so I moved to Aberdeen. So no, it wouldn't have been 97, it would have been 99. But yeah, I was about, would I have been about 25, 26? Yeah, because it was like the year after I went. And I went and I got it. I went through the interview and I knew I had it. Trusted my gut instinct, but I knew it was in the bag. And I thought, well, it's a new start for me. It's a new city. It's by the sea, which was the reason why I picked it.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it's a new start. And I can remember going, and it was like I gradually reduced the Prozac by that stage. It was like, I think I was taking one once a month or something like that. But it was a crutch as well. So I can remember being feeling quite anxious when I moved there. I lived in the nurse's home and thinking, do I need doctors again? But there was a real fear for me of, and I think this is true of a lot of people, of stopping taking the antidepressant, even though I knew it was better. But that fear, what's to stop me from this happening again?
Yeah, and it's very difficult to know when you're going through it to what extent you feeling better is because of the medication and whether that improvement would just go if you stop.
Yeah, and I can remember my mum saying to me, "How do you know you know, are you sure I need to start continuing tablets? And my question to her was, well, how do you know this is just me or it's the medication? Do you know? Mm-hmm. It was kind of patch 22, but I think the recommendations generally for Prozac is like about 6 months is the recommendation, I think, for taking it. So I went off it and got into nursing and student nurse and had a ball. You know, I really enjoyed it. But there was always that. I think the reason I went into nursing was because I thought to myself, when I become a nurse, I'll be confident. I'll have to be confident. But nursing kind of trains you to be a nurse. But it doesn't allow you to look at yourself personally.
Yeah, and I imagine that's completely different to your experience training in counselling then.
Oh, 100%.
So how much later was it you moved into that then?
So 10 years, kind of, yeah, about 10 years. And I had been, as I said, I've been very lonely in Aberdeen. And I also, I'd also been diagnosed with seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah.
And I can remember, because at Aberdeen, as you know, was the days are very short there, and especially in the winter. And
yes.
I remember going to the GP and saying to the GP, I think I have this condition, but I think, I don't know if it exists. And I said to her, and she's like, oh, I have it. You know, and I have my light box. And it was just like, oh, such a relief.
Yeah.
To hear that, to know that it wasn't this scatty American, because Americans, no offense to them, but can sometimes be very, you know, on a different sphere to ourselves. Sometimes, not always. So that was kind of my impression. So got a light box, and that made a huge, huge difference to me. But the loneliness was still there. And when you're working shifts, it's not very good for your social life.
No.
And so I joined, at the time, Match.com was one of the agencies, dating agencies, and everyone seemed to be using it to meet partners. There was quite a few nurses that had senior staff that had used it to unsuccessfully and met their husbands. So I went down that road. But unfortunately, I met somebody who was extremely manipulative, and I ended up in an abusive relationship. And that was weird. And people say to me now, how on earth could you have ended up, you know, you're so strong, and how could you have ended up in that relationship? But I was very lonely.
Yeah.
And they're extremely manipulative. That, you know, that's the whole thing about abusive relationships, is that it manipulates you. And so I moved with him to...
But also, I think it's important, yeah, saying on that as well, people may see a very different side to you now and see how strong and resilient you are. But generally, those relationships start when you're the opposite. And manipulative people, those that have regular relationships where they're the abusive partner, they look to target someone that's weak or that's lonely in some way, because it gives them more power. Would you agree?
Yeah, and it's so subtle. So what I would say to anyone, if you're starting a relationship and you have a sinking feeling in your stomach and that person kind of makes you feel uncomfortable, walk away, because you don't deserve, nobody deserves to be treated that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about being accepted for who you are. And I'm very lucky now, because I have an amazing husband who has totally changed my life. You know, being in a relationship with him and the work I have done, it's just very, like, my life really is unrecognizable to what it was even 10 years ago, do you know, when I first met him. So, yeah, so that was hard. And it wasn't at the time that I realized, I suspected, and I had a really great friend who knew that, you know, this was an abusive relationship. But I, you know, and she got me home from Scotland, back home to mum and dad again. So I was very lucky, you know, that my parents have been extremely supportive in my life in general. So yeah, so that was tough. What was when I came home that I actually realised, crap, it's happened again. You know, I've been another abusive, and I really hit rock bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I got, because you have to go through the police clearance door, because the staff nurse had to go through all that again. And I eventually got a permanent post in a ward that I shouldn't. By that stage, I think I really was burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a permanent job in heart ward cardiology, but it was like a high dependency. And I'm not, because that underlying confidence and self-esteem had never been dealt with. It just was too pressurized for me, and I folded. I absolutely folded.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then, I was around the same time I met my husband, and I thought, do you know what? I can do this. I can do counselling.
Yeah. And what sort of age were you then?
So that was 37, 38. And then I was dating my husband, and then we got married. And then the year after we got married, I started my training to be a therapist. So yeah, so about 6 years ago I started. Yeah.
It's quite interesting years. Because that's something I see replicated quite a lot in counsellors, that they often do go to it a little bit later, and they maybe have the inkling of it earlier, but it's such a tough profession, and it's particularly on you. You have to do so much internal work so that you can separate out. When you're in the room with the client, it's just you and them, so you need to have that really high level of self-awareness.
Yes.
That if they tell you a story about, for example, an abusive relationship, you can tell the difference between is how I'm reacting and how I'm feeling about my experience, or is that reflecting the client? Because otherwise you can reflect them back in quite an inappropriate way.
Absolutely. And I think that is definitely a process. And, you know, we talk about the gift of therapy, that clients can, you know, there can be times that clients, has happened to me recently, that, you know, one of my parents wasn't very well, and I went to the session, and this client fed back to me a lot of this. They've been coming for quite a while, but they fed back, and in a way they nurtured me, and I've never had that happen. Well, I have had it, but not to that same degree, you know, so it was really powerful. But yeah, everyone thinks that counsellors are like fixed if everything's sort of their lives. No, we absolutely haven't. There's still, you know, there's still stuff that comes up, you know, and that's why it's really important that we go to supervision and, you know, and we go to therapy as well, because, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect human being.
Yeah, counsellors need counsellors too.
Yeah, they absolutely do. So I think going back to that, well, you said about that inkling to be a counsellor, it was definitely there in my nurse's training. You know, when we'd done a module on communication skills, and I can remember the tutor saying to me and my friend, if you ever think, we had to do a video as part of our assessment, if you ever think about a different career, you should maybe think about counselling. And I thought, oh yeah, I'd like to do that. But as you say as well, you have to look at yourself. And I kind of went,
And that can be really tough, feeling ready to go through that process, that self-examination.
Yeah, and I suppose that's where my husband came in, that he has been supportive, you know, in a number of ways, financially and emotionally. He's been amazing. But I was ready for it as well. I knew that's the road that I wanted to go down. I love it. You know, it's just been so rewarding in my life.
Brilliant.
And I always was, you know, I was always the person at the bus stop that people would tell kind of their story to.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. So I myself get person-centered counselling, and that's the one, therefore, I'm most aware of. But yeah. Other guests have talked about CBT as well, and I understand that that can be really helpful in terms of taking a more kind of practical approach in some ways to being like trying to build up your skills. So for example, if someone is anxious to the point where they can't leave the house, then maybe like a CBT over the phone or through Skype or however it is, maybe the thing that's essential to build up those tools so they can feel comfortable going out. And for many people, they may need something like that before they can even get to the person-centered counseling and drill down into what's causing those things.
Yeah, and that's interesting because that's probably where I started. That was the first when I went to the counsellor at the end of my nurse's training. That's what I used. It was cognitive behavioural therapy. You can learn about cognitive behavioural therapy really quickly in maybe six sessions, whereas I think person-centred is a process. It's a process that you go on. People say, oh, there's all these different types of counselling. Mm-hmm. The most important thing is your relationship with the therapist.
Yes.
That's what the research says, and it's about trusting your therapist. So that's the most important part of the process, is being with someone you think, yeah, they get me, they understand me.
I'm so glad that you've mentioned that point as well, because from guests we've heard from in the past, that can be something that holds them back, is that they try out something like counselling and for whatever reason they don't connect with that first counsellor they deal with, and it can put them off counselling in general. But actually, just like any kind of relationship, there are people that you will connect with and some people you won't. And often you know that in the first session, but they're all different. And so it's definitely worth giving another shot.
So it's who you connect with. And it could be you check out different therapists, but just kind of, you know, check out what they're saying. Talk to them on the phone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things really do make a difference, because, and it's about valuing that relationship, because if you don't value it, you're not going to get the best from it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd say that's an important point too for our listeners, that don't be afraid to ask them questions, because in many cases, for example, you know, particularly private counselling, you are going to have that initial kind of consultation, and that's mm-hmm. as much your time to understand the counsellor as it is their time to understand your needs. So if there is something that you are going through that you feel they really need to have a specialism in, so if, for example, it's something like grief that's brought you to counselling, there are counsellors that specialise in that, and the counsellors that will have more or less experience. So definitely ask them the question if it's something they've worked with many other clients on. I think we've led in quite well into some of the barriers that can stop people from seeking counselling they need. Are there any other things you've noticed that can often hold people back from getting counselling?
I think the fear of actually committing, of acknowledging that they've got an issue, you know, but that is like, that's so powerful. Seem to recognise, actually, I've got an issue and I need help with that. That's really hard to do, to turn around and say, actually, I've got a problem. Actually, I think I need some help with this. That's a strength. I see that as a strength. Absolutely. For someone to turn around and say, this is, you know, this is a problem that I need help with.
Yeah, absolutely. And to add to that, it's important to remember that you going to a counsellor, that's their job. Every day they're getting new people into their practice who need very similar things to you, probably. And so they're not going to be shocked by you needing help. They're not going to be shocked by any diagnosis you've had. That's their work. That's their specialism.
Yeah, definitely. And I'd also say, just to make sure that they're registered, like in Ireland we have the Irish Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy, we have IHIP, which is humanistic. You know, there is a lot, make sure your counsellor is registered with an organisation or BACP.
So that's the one for us here, is BACP. We don't want to scare anyone off trying counselling, but absolutely it's important to just make sure that person's credentials are what you think they are.
Yeah.
And you can check that easily by just ringing the association or checking online, and they won't be offended if you ask.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Grand. Okay. Is there any others you'd like to finish up on?
I think that's kind of covered it. But I'd say really useful tools for people in general is journaling. And I mean pen and paper. And writing down how you're feeling, you know, and your thoughts. Because that is actually a really, really useful way of kind of dumping whatever's going on for you. Yeah. And I mean, mindfulness is everywhere. But the great thing about mindfulness is that you always have it with you. And there's so many apps out there that can be helpful. And a third one I would put in is gratitude. So every day writing down the at least three things that you're thankful for. And really small things like, you know, driving to work and every traffic light was green, or you got into work and it started raining, or do really small things, you know, and it does make a difference. To your health, they would be the three things I'd recommend. I would recommend to my clients.
Yeah, absolutely. My mum does that last one actually before she goes to bed. She'll write things she's grateful for, and she finds it really helps set her up for sleep because it puts her mind in that positive place, focusing on the positives rather than any worries that may come up for many people at that time.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. So just before we finish then, you wanted to tell people about your Facebook page if they want to learn more about you?
So I have two. I've got one's called Here For You, and I put different things up. It comes and goes. I'm going to try and get a little bit better at it. Just useful blogs, but that's how people can contact me on Facebook.
Great. Thank you. So I'll put the link for that in the description as well. So thank you so much for being part of the episode today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been very interesting and useful for me. From every encounter that we have with people, we always learn something new. So thanks, Bobby.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. If you haven't already heard, we've started a petition to make mental health education mandatory in all schools. If this is something that you're passionate about too, and you'd consider signing such a petition or even just reading about it to learn more, you can find it by visiting bit.ly/mentalpetition. The link for this is also in the description. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.